From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland.
Hello from South Berkeley, below Ashby.
I live in North Richmond.
Kentfield.
Coming up, we'll look inside a negotiation involving the city of Oakland, a housing developer, and a very vocal public.
Their job is to maximize their financial return to their investors. Your job is to maximize the community return to your people.
Then an artist breaks down why it's so important for people of color to tell their own stories.
It's not just how they affect white people. It's actually also how they affect us, how we can perceive ourselves.
And we'll find out the answer to this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
Every other Wednesday and every Friday and Saturday night, it's nothing but drag, drag, drag.
Get ready for the show. Cross Currents is next. For decades, investors didn't want to touch Oakland. In 1997, one economist called the city an ugly duckling in a bay of swans. But these days, Oakland is one of the hottest, fastest-growing real estate markets in the country, and developers want in on the action. There are more than 15,000 housing units in the pipeline right now. Anti-displacement activists see an opportunity for the city to demand public benefits from developers, things like pitching in to pay for affordable housing, hiring only local workers, or investing in public beautification. The city has leverage, but how far can it push developers before they back out? To find out, KALW's Liza Veal took a look at one development project near downtown.
Oakland has a housing shortage. For every 10 new jobs the region has created, it's only added one new unit of housing. Here's the mayor, Libby Schaff, at her State of the City speech earlier this year.
We must learn the cautionary lesson from San Francisco and not discourage market rate housing. We have to have new housing so that the people who are moving into Oakland don't push out the people who are already here.
So I'm just going to walk a little bit east from Telegraph, crossing Broadway. And then right here, when you get to 23rd and Valdez, it's this huge two-block parking lot. But soon, it's going to be a big development. To the city, emptier commercial areas like 23rd and Valdez are ideal for development because there's no one there to displace. But for developers, to build here is to make a bet that people will actually want to live here.
It is a tough sell to get investors on board.
This is Bruce Dorfman. He's principal at Thompson Dorfman, the developer of this site. They have over 20 buildings in the Bay Area, big recognizable ones like the Bay Street Mall in Emeryville. But this is his first in Oakland because, he says, the time is finally right.
It's actually changed in the past, I'm going to say, year to 18 months, where suddenly institutional investors have said, yeah, Oakland, we understand the story. Oakland has, turned the bend, and we're interested in investing there. That's a new phenomenon.
The city has done a lot to try to induce construction. They've created neighborhood plans for the areas that need to grow. They've updated zoning and taken care of environmental assessments so developers don't have to. So the city makes it a little easier for developers. The developers get interested. So far, so good. But those aren't the only two players. The city's also got all kinds of pressure from the public to not sell out their town. This chanting is from a recent anti-displacement protest. Some activists think the city shouldn't sell off land that's publicly owned, like that parking lot we're talking about, without asking for community benefits in exchange, things like help with building affordable housing.
Hashtag development without displacement.
So the city has to do a balancing act, keep developers and their investors interested while leveraging that interest to get some benefits the public wants. So how'd the deal go down?
There is no question that there was a negotiation that goes on. There was a lot of horse trading that went on.
For starters, they agreed to a closed negotiation process with one developer, Dorfman. He was interested, the city didn't want to lose him, so they committed and sold the parcel for $9.5 million. The price of the land was determined by an appraisal rather than by auction, so there was no bidding.
There are certain things that we're doing that benefit the developer.
Patrick Lane is the city staffer that negotiated the deal.
His background is in affordable housing. He has an earring. His uncle calls him a communist. But he thinks the city did the right thing here.
Our goal is to build the housing. It's not to get the best deal. It's to get a good deal and to get the housing done as well.
Okay, so that's what the city gave. Now let's talk about what the city got.
I mean, there is some affordable housing on the site.
For 15% of the housing, that's 36 out of the 234 units, Dorfman won't charge market rate, and he'll make sure that they go to low-income people. It was a savvy move on Dorfman's part because, as you heard earlier, the public has gotten organized.
Impact fee proposal, and I have 112 speakers.
Wow.
Over 100 people spoke up at a recent city council meeting to point out that Oakland is one of the only Bay Area cities that does not have rules forcing developers to help pay for affordable housing. They're pushing the city to create something called an impact fee.
You know that developers' long list of fees and things, like this is nothing new for them.
The fee basically says to developers, your housing project will bring people to this community who will use public infrastructure, like parks and transportation. So you should help mitigate that impact by paying up. At the meeting, the city heard from residents like Jen McKillops.
We are not a cheap date. $5,000 is a joke for developers.
And housing researchers like Sasha Hauswald.
And frankly, we were a little surprised that economists cannot find many places where impact fees reduce the rate of housing development. The effect of an impact fee is virtually negligible. It's like pouring a cup of water onto a wave.
And advocacy leaders like Gloria Bruce.
I speak to you as an Oakland mother of two boys of color and as a child of an African-American family whose city has been made unrecognizable by gentrification. Listen to what your people are telling you.
Delays by the community can put a project underwater. Dorfman circumvented all that by agreeing to 15% affordable housing up front. For some activists, that's not enough. But Oakland's Patrick Lane says it's the most the city can expect.
They wouldn't do more than the 15%. It really wouldn't. We looked at it really closely. So we really think we got a good deal.
Lane says it's the investors, not developers, who walk away when a project becomes too costly. And investors, they can go to any market in the world. They don't have to play by our local rules.
You can't dictate when people will invest. So if you want their money to build the housing, you have to take what they're willing to spend it on, so the kinds of returns that they want.
The rents in the new development will be expensive. One bedrooms will go for $2,600. The subsidized one-bedroom units will go for $1,400, and the extra subsidized will go for $870. Housing researcher and advocate Gloria Bruce, you heard her at the impact fee meeting earlier, she says there's no way to bring down the market rate prices. So the city needs to look at other solutions.
And so I really think we need to be looking at approaches that are outside of the market and when we can, facilitating nonprofit development and really investing in deeply affordable homes.
Why didn't the city sell the land to a nonprofit developer? Patrick Lane says, basically, if the city doesn't get construction rolling ASAP, it could miss this boom and miss all the revenue that comes from selling land and collecting property taxes. With that money, Oakland could fund anti-displacement efforts and build affordable housing on less expensive land. He says this is another strategy for dealing with Mayor Schaaf's number one priority.
My highest priority is preventing displacement of our long-term residents.
Construction at 23rd and Valdez should break ground in about a year, assuming the developers get investors on board. In Oakland, I'm Liza Veal for Cross Currents.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hanna Baba. And now, we're going to hear from one Oakland local who's made her hometown a source of artistic inspiration. Visual artist and cultural organizer Fabiana Rodriguez grew up in the Fruitvale District in East Oakland, far from her parents' native Peru. She says she wants to change how immigrants and other marginalized groups are portrayed so that the full spectrum of people's stories can be shown. In addition to making her own work, she's the director of Culture Strike, a national art and activist organization, and she's the co-founder of Presente.org, whose aim is to empower Latino communities. KALW's Jen Sheehan spoke with Fabiana Rodriguez about the power of art to shape our cultural and political realities.
I think it's safe to say that you're one of the most visible activist artists out in the country today. What would you say is the thread that ties all of your work together?
The thread is that I want to change the narrative around how people of color and immigrants are portrayed. Our stories don't get shared in the cultural realm, in music, in literature, in film, in the visual arts. What you see is tired and dated tropes of who we are as people of color, as first and second generation migrants, as queer folks, as women. And I really want to complicate that. And I want to not just fight against problematic narratives, but also to create new narratives that will further complicate and really show our full humanity.
Can you talk a little bit about how your background and how your childhood or your experience growing up influences how you think about how you want to change that narrative?
I grew up in the very traditional immigrant family where I was very sheltered. My parents were all about education. Both of my parents each had two jobs at least. And it was all about getting straight A's and making sure I was in math and science engineering camp on the weekends and after school. And in that way, I felt that I very much mimic the traditional narrative of migrants, which is that your parents come, they don't have a college education, you're usually the first to go to college.
You start climbing the ladder supported by your parents' multiple jobs.
And you know, I was one of the only people in my community to go to college. Many of my peers went to jail. Many of my peers were pregnant at a very young age. So I always felt like kind of like the model minority. I would always get invited to speak about what it was to grow up in the hood and, you know, in a very tokenizing way. And when you were
growing up, did you realize that or did you recognize or feel like a token or was it later that you...
I later began to understand that it was much more complicated than what was on the surface. And I understood that, I would say, when I was 21 and I had an abortion, which I have no regrets about. It was the right decision for me. I realized that there's a whole nother layer of silence that occurs in our community, and that even in the way that we're portrayed, we are not shown as full human beings.
In the media,
and even with our own communities, the emphasis is often so much on productivity and on getting ahead in this very traditional American capitalist context. And if
you stray from that, we don't want to talk about it.
We don't want to talk about it. And we also don't get to show ourselves in the way that white people, the narratives about white people. Because I grew up watching all kinds of, you know, Pretty in Pink and 16 Candles where teenagers were messy. You know, teenagers got to express themselves sexually and they got to experiment with drugs and all that. All that was very open. It was part of this kind of national narrative,
right,
of what
the
it meant
American
to find
way
yourself.
Of,
yeah,
of
and
the
I felt
teenager.
Like, you know, and I just felt like, wow, that story is not being told. And the way that I'm being presented actually not just hurts the way people see me, but it hurts the way I see myself. It ultimately disempowers me. Cultural narratives are not just about us. Like the way that narratives about who we are as people, it's not just how they affect white people. It's actually also how they affect us, how we can perceive ourselves. So as an artist, I'm very much about showing all of that.
So would you say that for you, becoming fully an artist and becoming fully, I guess, politicized or political in your viewpoint came together at the same time?
I feel that the arts is a place to be free. And I feel that politics often can be a bit simplified. And although I'm a huge advocate for social justice, I believe that the arts adds a dimension to politics that is about being free and is about really embracing who we are as full human beings.
Right. You've said that art can shape politics in a way that no other medium can.
Yes.
Can you kind of dig into that a little bit? What does that mean to you?
Well, first is that politics, if you look at how politics work, politics is often about laws and policies. And who's deciding on these policies? Well, it's overwhelmingly white men. When we are trying to get laws changed, often we are thinking about and working within what's politically feasible, right? So we are saying, for example, let's stop the deportations. Let's get cameras on these police, right? Let's figure out training systems. What's politically feasible is not where we should start. I think we need to start in the space of the imagination. I think that we need to completely question some of these systems. It's the same thing with climate change. We have a conversation about how much CO2 is in the air. We have a conversation about, you know, green energy, right?
Car emissions.
What we don't have a conversation about is completely rethinking our consumption patterns and really questioning, hey, you know what, this the way that we feel entitled to stuff, especially in this country, we're using 17 more times energy than anyone else. We need to completely reimagine our futures.
And so you're saying politics is not the arena for that.
Politics is not the space for that. The arts is the space for that, because the arts offers us a space to completely dream. For example, I would love to see a world without borders, you know, and that's a place that I can create in my artwork. I can't talk to a congressman about eliminating borders. They just won't. That's not
Does
even a place for them to start.
It uh-huh. does not.
And yet, I still believe that we need to imagine a world without gender. Imagine if I propose that to a politician, a world without gender. They don't even know where to start. So for me, the arts is a place to really think big, to think with our imagination, and to completely reimagine systems.
That was visual artist, activist, and cultural organizer Fabiana Rodriguez speaking with KALW's Jen Sheehan. Fabiana's work will be featured in a new exhibition opening at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco tomorrow. It's called Take This Hammer, Art Plus Media Activism. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. And now, it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
Every other Wednesday and every Friday and Saturday night, it's nothing but drag, drag, drag.
How are we all doing tonight? You guys ready to see a fabulous show?
I'm 60, almost 60 friggin' 4 years old, and I'm still doing this because I love it.
Think you know what that was and where we recorded it? We sent KALW's Hannah Kingsley Ma to the Tenderloin to tell us more.
Okay, hold on. 13 is your first one?
Yes, and this one is my other one.
And one?
Yes, 13 and one. This is writing it down right now.
One and one, 13 and one. I'll get yours in a minute, so.
That faint buzzing you hear, it's the sound of the beer-filled refrigerators lining the walls of a tiny, fluorescent-lit storage area, which four drag queens are currently using as their dressing room.
I have a Cher medley, and I do Cher before liposuction, because I'm a little bit heavy.
That's Olivia Hart. She's been performing here for the past 5 years.
Every other Wednesday, and every Friday and Saturday night, it's nothing but drag, drag, drag.
Welcome to Aunt Charlie's Lounge, a Tenderloin institution that's one of the oldest gay bars in San Francisco.
And we're real drag queens, honey. We're real drag queens.
Hi, I'm Joie de Vivre. I'm just a little Cajun queen.
Joie de Vivre has an old school glamour about her. Her blue sequin mini dress catches the light and sparkles, and she's dripping in fake diamonds. There's even a performer who goes on stage as a man, a rarity, he tells me, in the world of drag. His name is Bobby Ashton. He has a few tricks up his sleeve.
I do male numbers, and I cross over and do camp drag near the end of the evening.
And Bobby has more costumes than all of us. We bring suitcases, Bobby brings a U-Haul.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Charlie's Lounge. How are we all doing tonight? You guys ready to see a fabulous show?
Yes!
You guys want to see some lovely drag queens?
The performers strut down the length of the bar, fanning their faces, sitting on laps, occasionally extending a hand to gently brush the cheek of an audience member. As they sashay past, I am left in an afterwave of perfume and hairspray. Sometimes they are close enough that I can hear them whispering the lyrics to the songs as they theatrically lip sync.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter.
Aunt Charlie's Lounge is part of a long legacy of queer spaces here in the Tenderloin. The neighborhood was a gathering place for LGBT people in the 1960s and 70s.
Aunt Charlie's is one of the last bars in the Tenderloin. There's Gangway, but Gangway's future is threatened.
That's James Hosking. He's not just a regular here. He's also the creator of Beautiful by Night, a documentary film and photo series about the performers at Aunt Charlie's. As luck would have it, I ended up sitting right at his table. He tells me even after the Castro overtook the Tenderloin as the city's gay mecca,
Aunt Charlie's kind of continued to exist and continued to be a place in which people could perform and have a community, and the bar could welcome transgender performers and, drag performers and be inclusive in a way.
That inclusivity he's talking about, it was forged in a large way because of the late Vicky Merlane, also known as the woman with the liquid spine.
I'm doing a halfway strip tonight. Can you imagine this body stripping? If I didn't do it, I'd be dead.
That was her in a 2011 documentary. Marlene was one of the country's first transgender performers, and she headlined at Aunt Charlie's Lounge for decades.
The performers here continue the passion that she had for the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a drag show, therefore, photography is absolutely mandatory. You ain't got no choice. It's a city ordinance. Okay, guys?
Drag's a visual medium. I, lowly radio reporter, cannot do the spectacle justice. It's just something you have to experience in person. But I can catalog the million different costume changes I saw in the span of one evening, just to give you a sense of how elaborate this production is. Leopard-patterned leotards, elegant ball gowns, red sequin jumpers, cat-eye glasses, a headpiece that looked like the lawful marriage between a Lucha Libre's closet and Liberace's, a gothic velvet dress with medieval sleeves, and some items of clothing too complicated or revealing in their construction for me even to attempt to describe. Bobby Ashton, the one with the U-Haul's worth of clothes, tells me this is a lot of work and requires most of all passion.
I don't think we make more than what we spend, you know, but that's the fun of it all. That's what we like to do.
He's been performing here for almost 20 years.
We're like the oldest queens here, okay? So a lot of people don't believe it when I say I'm 60, almost 60 friggin' 4 years old, and I'm still doing this because I love it.
Colette Le Ashton Grand, who founded this crew of drag queens back in 1997, is working tonight as a cocktail waitress. She butts in, her hands full of drinks.
You old!
Yes.
She was asking me, girl, how long do I want to perform?
70 at the latest, okay? 70, I'm calling it quits.
That's kind of the most crucial thing about Aunt Charlie's. No one here is calling it quits. It's a pretty big deal, considering that it's one of the last remaining historic gay bars in the neighborhood. Gangway, the city's oldest gay bar half a mile away, just announced its closing after 50 years. That comes on the heels of the Lexington, San Francisco's last lesbian bar, and Esta Noche before that. Regulars like James Hosking don't want that to happen to Aunt Charlie's.
Being in Aunt Charlie's, you kind of feel the sense of history of the area. And so I worry that if the Tenderloin was radically changed and radically gentrified, we would lose that sense of what San Francisco was to people and the sense of what it could be to those who kind of came here seeking solace and an opportunity to perform and an opportunity to be who they were without compromise.
The drag queens here at Aunt Charlie's are determined to keep doing what they're doing. At this point, their performances are woven into the texture of this neighborhood, its history, its sense of place. Take it from Olivia Hart.
We're fabulous. We're gay. We're friendly. We're out there. Whatever you want to do, come to the Tenderloin and let's do it. Just don't hurt anybody.
For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Kingsley Ma.
Want to know more about the performers at Aunt Charlie's? We've got a link to the documentary Beautiful by Night on our website. Go to KALW.org and click on Audiograph. Our winner this week knew all about Aunt Charlie's. Big congratulations to Ron Robbins. You're getting a KALW t-shirt. Do you have ideas for where we should record next? What are the sounds of where you live? Give us a call and tell us. 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. I really love hearing from you. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. And for all you Cross Currents fans out there, subscribe to our podcast. You can hear Cross Currents when you want and catch up on past episodes. You can even search our shows by subject. Find out how at kalw.org/subscribe. Our team includes Shireen Adel, Hannah Baba, Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ian Lewis, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Raja Shah, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. Line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Our managing producer is Julie Kane. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.